grab your beverages and turn up your interweb. Solving the world's problems 12 ounces at a time. It's Dudes and Beer. Well, hello everybody, and welcome to episode 166, a very special episode 166, coming to you live on a Sunday morning. I am awake and fresh after a decent night's sleep from 2 weeks on the road in sunny Orlando, Florida. It was not that sunny. It rained quite a bit while I was there, but had a great show, had a great trip. So long to all of my Sapphire and Road family who are tuned in. I will see y'all very soon. And I am now back in Austin, Texas, and have the amazing opportunity to sit down with financial expert and author of The Entrepreneurial Instinct, Miss Monica Mehta, this morning to discuss the what has become known as the trade war with China. How are you doing this morning, Monica?
Doing well. So good to chat with you, Chris.
Absolutely. Yeah, we did have a little bit of a late start, but that's because I probably haven't spoken with Monica in about 30 years. So we had to quickly glaze over some personal history and be like, hey, how's it going? we know each other from many, many years ago, and she has gone down this incredible career path, both as a financial analyst, working in finance, helping entrepreneurial folks start their businesses, things like that. She has a great grasp on really the way that the economy affects average people is what I'm getting. So tell us a little bit about your book, The Entrepreneurial Instinct, Monica. What brought you to write that, and where you are right now?
Sure. So The Entrepreneurial Instinct published in 2012, and it really looked at this idea of, are entrepreneurs born or made? And at the core, the book really looks into the physiology of entrepreneurial risk-taking. So are some people just wired out of the gate to be good at taking risks? And this topic was of interest to me for very, very personal reasons. So I'm the daughter of entrepreneurs. My father was a merchant marine ship's captain. My mom was an artist. And we moved to the U.S. when I was five, and the types of jobs that my dad could get paid him a fraction of what he had made before. And I guess he had the choice to either accept that or try something different. And he took a big chunk of his savings and started a business. And he had zero background in the type of business that he started. And it was really just, you know, feeling your way through the dark is what I would describe it, like having a front row seat to that experience, like watching my parents do what they were doing. They had no business training. They wrote no business plans, but they went from the whole $7 in your pocket to multimillionaires. For me, it was a very different story. I was a very good student, and I ran just as hard at school as my parents did at their business. And I had my eyes set on the Ivy Leagues from a young age. I'm not sure who pulled me aside and said that I should do that. Maybe it was Alex P. Keaton on Family Ties. I don't know. But I bought into this idea that get into a good school, you get a good job, and that's how you make your life. And it was, I guess, every kid rebels from what they see their parents do. But
sure.
So at the end of the day, after doing all of that, I realized what I wanted was to be just like them. I wanted to be an entrepreneur myself, but having more access to capital, having a better education than they did, having great work experience, I found that I was constantly looking at ideas, but never taking the risk and starting a business on my own. So it was an incredibly frustrating thing for me to feel like I'm doing everything right, and I can't take the risks that my parents could take with zero training at all. And so that was the reason I started looking into, well, is there something to this idea that part of all of this is innate? And so I started, it started as a very organic experience. I just started talking to self-made entrepreneurs that from the outside had no business being as successful as they were. And as I started talking to them, you know, I started to hear very similar things pop up in terms of how they would talk about, you know, just a general focus on optimism, a general focus on problem solving. And then kind of as a left turn, a friend in New York connected me to behavioral psychologists that were studying the financial markets. And they also connected me to neuroscience researchers. And as we started talking about, you know, the science of behavior and the science of the brain, what came out was some really interesting research out of Cambridge University that actually goes to the crux of this idea that, hey, there's something to this idea that some of us are kind of wired to take risks. So sure. the book is a collection of, you know, stories with entrepreneurs as well as, you know, hard research on neuroscience and behavioral psychology that tries to get to the nut of, are entrepreneurs born or are they made? And if they are born a certain way, can we still learn something from, you know, what we see works for these folks? And again, it was a deeply personal thing for me to research. And I've been pretty lucky because I've treated most of the stuff that I've done in media as just a hobby. Like, this is just something I do because I'm intellectually curious and it makes me happy. And I'd get very bored if I didn't have the opportunity to look at all of these different questions in life. And that's what mattered to me back then. And I'm working on a new book now on what matters to me now, which is 180 degrees from that topic.
And what is that book about?
Yeah, so for the past 3 years, I've been researching the history of women. So the book I'm writing now is all about women and power, and it's basically challenging this idea that things are always just getting better and better and better. So this linear arc to social justice, like this idea that, you know, the arc is long and wide, and we ultimately get to a place of justice. If you look at the situation for women, it's really far more complicated. So women in Egypt in 2000 BC had property and inheritance rights. They, you know, they were free to get divorced, all of this stuff. Flash forward to the U.S. and Great Britain in the 1800s, women were the property of their husbands. This is, you know, with coverture and chattel law. And if you look at India, India is a really interesting example of this idea that things aren't always moving forward. So the oldest doctrines of Hinduism basically list divinity as neither masculine nor feminine. So the Vedas is the oldest scriptures of Hinduism, and it's believed to be more than 5,000 years old. But you go to India today, and the G20 lists India as the worst place to be a woman on the planet of all developing countries. So, and it gets this bad rap because there's 63 million girls missing from society. And that's because abortion is legal. And guess who gets aborted? It's the female fetuses. 98% of abortions are female fetuses. There's statistics from the government that show 57% of adolescent boys believe it's okay for a husband to beat his wife. 53% of adolescent girls believe it's okay. 85% of domestic abuse happens in front of extended family members who watch this happen. You know, the book that I'm working on is called Backslide, and it's about this idea that empowerment isn't a straight line. It can have peaks and troughs. But the idea is that history can be very instructive. So if we can dig into the past and kind of understand the factors that were at play when women were doing well in society and when the status of women declines, then maybe we can have a better shot at improving the situation for women in the future. And a big part of what I've seen as I've been studying the past is that it's very driven by class. So the Ivanka hugely. Trumps of the world... The Ivanka Trumps of the world are always going to be treated with exception to, you know, the middle class person or the person at the bottom. And where you really start to see these cycles and the trends are when you focus in on the middle. And so I've been working with National Geographic, their anthropologists and scientists, for the past 3 years, digging into key parts of history. I've been talking to feminist leaders. I had the opportunity to go to Gloria Steinem's house for tea, which was pretty incredible.
Wow.
I've been talking to Islamic feminists, Raheel Raza, Azra Nomani, and business leaders. And so it's a really multidisciplinary approach to understanding just the nut of the topic is women and power, and what are the factors that impact power. And if I'm right, and that empowerment isn't a straight line and it's ups and downs, everything I'm seeing as I study society today show the vibrations of a backslide that we're already in, and one that can get much, much worse. So,
it could get horribly worse.
Yeah. So for anyone with a daughter, I feel like, or anyone who's concerned about like what kind of world we're going to be leaving for the next generation, it's really important to understand these things. And it's, I never really self-identified as a feminist. I absolutely believe that women are equal, if not better than men. I don't identify with a lot of political ideologies in general. I don't see myself as a Democrat or a Republican. I don't care much for any of these labels, but as this started becoming very important to me and what I was experiencing in my own life, I found myself absolutely addicted. Like I couldn't just, it was another moment where I was drowning in my need to learn more about all of these different things that I was uncovering. And this book will be out next spring, and I'm very excited about it.
Oh, well, I am hugely excited to read about that because it's something that, we've discussed numerous times on this show is the fact that there does seem to be a backslide to society going on, and not just in our country but across the world right now, and it's very interesting to see. And if you do especially take a society such as India, that it still does live in a utter caste system. Where a caste system still exists, and there's still stratification of the classes where certain people cannot talk to other people. That's just how it is. It utterly affects everything in the way that society and people interact with each other to begin with. And if people remember history, America was the great experiment. That's what our founding fathers, those great philosophers, called it, was the great experiment. This was going to be the first time ever that this kind of society would exist in the history of man, where there wasn't like a ruling king lording over everybody. And it's interesting to see how far this great experiment has even come. And what's happened with it and where we are headed as a society and as a people. So to see you actually cracking that nut is absolutely amazing and phenomenal. Kudos to you for that.
Oh, no, thank you. I mean, I feel very blessed to have the opportunity to even dig into it. I think the greatest thing anyone can ever give you, or the greatest thing you can give yourself, is a sense of purpose. And I have never been happier in life than when I'm in those moments where I'm just asking questions and giving myself the leash to dig into them and find the answers.
Yeah. And it, as you bring that up, let's kind of let the leash off of Monica Mehta for a moment. And, let her go into a little bit of this trade war that is going on. We keep hearing about it so much, and as we talked about prior to air, the media has different ways of putting things, different ways of spreading stories out there, putting things out. There is definitely a trade situation going on. Is it a trade war, as we've been told, Monica?
I can't even think of the word situation anymore without thinking of the Jersey Shore. So that's a little side note. But there is certainly a situation happening here. We're not quite at war, but what's interesting is there are some paradigms that we've just sort of accepted in society, right? So that trading across the world is good. You know, good things come from this. But I think where Trump had a bit of success in 2015, 2016, was he had a good nose for some of the issues that were actually on the mind of regular people, as did Bernie Sanders.
Sure.
So, like, I think that election was a very interesting situation of establishment versus non-establishment, and I think the establishment is so tied to the regular course of politics that they missed the fact that, you know, there's, despite the stock market being at all-time highs and despite the, you know, the economy looking like, from all the numbers, looking great, there's a big swath of America that hasn't been doing so great. And this is an issue that actually matters to a lot of people. In the 1970s, you had a situation where, you know, the average blue-collar factory worker could earn enough money to support a family of four. And as those jobs have gone away, I mean, it's trickled down into a number of different effects in society that mm-hmm. have created, I mean, the face of poverty in America today is a single mom with a child. And
yeah.
A single mom is 2.5 more times likely to live in poverty than the father of that child. And you can trace some of those trends back to this idea of men, you know, a whole generation of American men who just can't afford to support a family anymore, and all of the impact that has on, you know, women, children, and the psychological impact for all of the players. It affects schools. It affects the quality of schools. It affects the quality of health. It affects, like, mental well-being all across the board. So what Trump managed to land into, or at least see, was that there's a lot of people suffering. And, you know, just these regular statistics that if you live on the East Coast or the West Coast or you went to a certain kind of school, like you're the top 20% of American society, if you have a stock portfolio, then you're doing better than 80% of people, right?
Yes. Yes.
So if you own your house, you're doing better than 60% of people. So the idea is that there's a big chunk of America that's been left behind, and we're getting so isolated from each other that we don't even see these trends anymore, because we just talk to people who share our opinions and ideas. And so he picked up on something that, you know, this whole anti-establishment populism movement picked up on something that is very real and is affecting people in very real ways. And so all of this conversation about trade is interesting to me because we've had a bipartisan focus on kind of gutting American industry for the past, you know, even in the last 30 years.
Oh, absolutely.
We have 5.8 million jobs disappeared since 2000. And a lot of these trade deals, again, it's bipartisan. You had Clinton supporting NAFTA, WTO, then you had Bush, then you had Obama, and TPP was really, you know, Obama administration was very supportive of TPP. And with all of these things, the trade deficits are always in the disfavor of the U.S. If you want to look at NAFTA, it's like $177 billion. We are the losers in that arrangement. WTO, it's $240 billion. Again, 5 million manufacturing jobs lost between 1997 and 2014. And then for the average worker who doesn't have a college education, it's estimated that their annual wages are $1,800 less per year just because of these trade agreements. And this is not from a Republican group. This is actually from, I think it's like a UC Berkeley study. It's like a very liberal group that found that detail.
And, you know, it's so interesting because as somebody who comes from a family of teachers, as someone who took shop class, things like that, when you start seeing the industrial trades, when you start seeing industrial arts disappearing as an option from schools, you're literally crippling yourself as an economy. You are removing that critical part of infrastructure We could build all the machines we want all day long via machine. We need somebody to go fix the machine at some point. At some point, it will boil down to a human hand touching something to fix it. And we have to have people that are, A, willing to do that, and B, understand that that's necessary. That blue-collar jobs, that average Joes are the ones, I mean, right now, one of the things I also wanted to talk to you about, I didn't even put it in the talking points online, was the UPS strike. I mean, UPS is getting ready to go on strike, folks. And do you realize what that would do? Like to businesses across the country, if they went on, if you're as old as myself, I will not reveal Monica's age, but if you remember the trucker strike that happened many, many moons ago, where the truckers just decided, you know what, maybe we just don't move things across the country until we're paid a proper wage and we're treated right and we get to actually sleep at night instead of driving for 72 hours straight to make our load. Until they were treated fairly, good God, the country shut down. There were grocery stores without food. There were, you know, everywhere had nothing. Gas stations, no gas. You don't realize until an infrastructure like that goes down exactly how necessary it is for everyday functionality.
Yeah, I mean, I think that over the last 50 years, I don't know exactly when it started, but we have managed our economy to this place where it's, you know, the haves and the have-nots for sure, right? And if you want to just take a look at consumers, you have asset-holding consumers and you have non-asset-holding consumers. And the asset-holding consumers are feeling good because stock prices are up, that the house that they own, the price of that has gone up. The labor market is tight. You know, they're feeling confident. If they leave their job, they can probably find another one. These people generally live in super zip codes, like they're clustered in certain parts of the country, and they went to the same schools. They generally only interact with one another. Then you've got non-asset holding people, right? And for non-asset holders, life's not good. I mean, they're stretched thin. 60% of Americans don't have $500 saved up for an emergency. Their wages are flat over the last 40 yep. years. And this is not a race thing anymore. It's an economic thing. If you look at people who make a certain amount of money or less,
I had to find my applause sound effect there, because I have been preaching that line on this show since I started it 3.5 years ago. Monica, is that make no mistake, folks, this is not an actual race issue going on in America. This is a class issue.
It's a class issue, and I'm not saying that there aren't a whole bag of terrible things that come in terms of, in the package of race as well. But what I'm trying to point a finger to is it's not just the color of your skin. It's how much money is in your wallet or in your bank account or isn't mm-hmm. in your money or bank account.
Exactly.
And it trickles into everything. And so this idea that we can just be a nation of consumers, as you're talking to, and that it's not going to have a bigger, like more strategic impact on the health of the nation. I think that you have to be living in a bubble to think that kind of world is possible. There's certainly a lot of jobs that have been lost because of mechanization, and that's just, you know, that's the flow of things. I don't want to say it's the natural course of things, but that's what's happening. But to also not take responsibility for the fact that we've been cutting lots of deals where we make it possible for corporations to outsource. We actually incentivize them to outsource jobs so that you know, we can have stuff made cheaper somewhere else. Like, and to suggest that that's good for consumers, well, it's good for the asset holders. Again, it's good for the people who own stocks because
that's right.
The large corporations' profits are better, so their stock price is going up. But again, the vast majority of people, these non-asset holders, are not doing well, and they're completely ignored. And it's you know, I don't know when this started, but we've basically tried to silence this group of people to suggest that it's not possible to feel the strain. If you're white and living in America, you're not allowed to be like poor and hopeless.
go ask anybody of any race that lives in the ghost town that is now Detroit. Detroit was once the throbbing, beating heart of the American economy, and it is almost a ghost town now. And it just to look at situations like that, to look at states like Michigan, all these states that were once thriving, big economies, where manufacturing has gone overseas. I mean, geez, we bailed out the auto industry not once but twice. And then made it to where they could just take all the jobs overseas and make more money, and leave everybody else in the wayside. Like you said, where it's great for the people that hold stocks in the companies, for the people on the ground who once worked at the company, who once worked on the assembly line. Not so great. We've lost quite a few of those hard on the floor, blue collar jobs because of deals like this.
80% of stock market wealth is held by 10% of people. So this idea that there are haves and have nots, I mean, you don't have to research very hard to find this information.
No.
So the other player in American society, so we talked about asset holders, non-asset holders, and there's corporations, right? So corporations love global trade. They love outsourcing. They love manufacturing on the cheap. And corporations have been doing better than your family for decades. Like, corporate earnings as a percentage of GDP is at an all-time high since the early 2000s. We've gotten to this place where what makes the stock market happy and keep shooting up is very misaligned with the average American. And it's very interconnected with this conversation of trade and globalization, because 50% of revenues for S&P 500 companies comes from overseas. 50% of profit for S&P 500 companies comes from overseas. So as these companies outsource, make things cheaper abroad, When that profit comes in, they don't use that money to grow lines of business in the U.S. and hire more people. So in the same way, this huge tax cut that we just made, I mean, it was a huge gift to these corporations. Is it gonna cause like this incredible boost to industry in the U.S.? I don't think so. Again, the corporations are not the party in this equation that have been hurting for a very long time. And again, all of these initiatives to promote global trade, it's completely bipartisan. It's not a Republican thing. It's not a Democrat thing. It's a corrupt politician thing. Like, this is how they pay back the big corporations that gave them money to run to begin with.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, a friend, it was funny, this last election, the large election that happened, not the small local elections, but the last national election that happened, was the first time that I ever saw the meme. And I contacted a friend of mine and went, "Oh my God, did you see that? Like, you put that idea out there 10 years ago." He was the first person that I ever heard say, "We may as well make them like wear NASCAR jackets, where they got patches all over them, like DuPont,
right?
You know, Facebook." I mean, it just cracked me up because, yeah, like, I sat and watched almost 3 days of testimony about the Facebook privacy hearings. And number one, it just frightened me that 80% of the people on the panel, number one, knew nothing about technology and how the internet works. And you're sitting on
the
panel.
They don't know about the interwebs?
Yeah. Yeah. What's that about?
It's a series of tubes and tunnels.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you remember that guy?
Yeah. Yeah. Precisely. And not just that, I want to say like 8 members of the panel had taken money from Facebook for their election campaign. So it's like, why are you even on this panel? Why? How are you possibly allowed on there? How is that possible?
This is a tale as old as time. I mean, I think the movie Mr. Smith Goes to Washington is from the 20s, late 20s or early 30s. But it's like you watch it and it's the exact same issues that you see now, which is money corrupts and buyer beware, right? Like you always have to look at who's talking and think a little bit about, well, where are they coming from and what are their motivations? But, you know, the thing about trade is, What I find interesting about the fact that trade is in the spotlight right now is that whoever is pushing this agenda forward to challenge these trade agreements is doing it at odds with the biggest corporations of America. The Republicans don't have an incentive to see this happen. The Democrats don't have an incentive to see this happen.
No.
So I think it's interesting that this is an issue that's being pushed forward, because I think there is a broad swath of America that, again, the elites don't interact with these people, but there's a big chunk of America that's hurting that could be benefited if there was some kind of change that happened here. And we're sort of at this unique place in time that we can actually challenge these agreements. You know, the stock market is as good as it's been, right?
Yeah.
The labor market is as good as it's been. The U.S. is not powered by exports. Exports represent less than 13% of the economy. So we are a consumer spending economy. Two-thirds of the economy is consumer spending. So provided that, markets don't crash and people get spooked, if you're ever going to challenge these ideas and try to shake things up and change things, you do it when things are good and you can withstand it, not when we're already feeling a lot of economic pressure. So as far as the impact of trade, Canada's our biggest trading partner. China's a very close number two.
Yeah.
So the industry
I was going to say we import a lot from China. And there's definitely a lot of production that happens in China from U.S. companies. And that's one of the big things that's being fought about right now is the copyright issues. People send things over there to have produced, and it was something that was done for many, many years. You know, if you walked into a Radio Shack many years ago, you can't do it now. They don't sell like home stereos and stuff, but they would have like a Sony stereo and a Sanyo, and then they had their version, which was basically Sanyo just rebranded, and it had a clock in it. And they had a deal with Sanyo. Yeah.
So Section 301 of the 1974 Trade Act, and it's basically China's been in violation of this act for decades, and it's forced tech transfers and the theft of intellectual property. So, Yeah, so if you start digging into this issue, what you'll find is, and I don't have a good example of this now, but I had to talk about it on CNN a couple of months ago when I think it was March when China was kind of in the news, trade with China was in the news. But it's this idea that it's like government-sponsored theft of intellectual property and nobody's doing anything about this.
Sure.
And the Chinese government's actually involved in this theft. So it's estimated that like theft of intellectual property costs us $50 to $60 billion a year. I mean, it's enormous.
Yeah.
So what's also interesting is the latest kind of thing we're talking about now in the last couple of weeks has been shaking up trade with the EU. So what's interesting is when we ship cars, automobiles are a big industry for the U.S., right? So when we ship cars to EU countries, they put a 10% tariff on U.S. cars. When EU cars come to the U.S., we charge them a 2.5% tariff on the cars coming in.
Yeah.
Have you heard that at any point in the news? Like, has anyone explained it that way?
No,
right.
No.
So this, like, that seems perfectly fair to challenge that, right? Why should my cars be more expensive when I'm selling them to you and your cars be, like, less expensive when you're selling them to me? That certainly doesn't seem like fair trade. So to challenge that seems intuitive, but it's all about presentation and storytelling, right? Like, so what are you being told and why are you being told it?
Well, and what cracks me up about all of it to begin with, the fact that it even exists, is that it's not even capitalistic. Like, how can you even do? We're a capitalist country, aren't we? About making money? What's going on there? Like, I just, I've failed to grasp it. I've failed to understand the logic behind it even happening to begin with. And the only way it happens is, well, like you said, people, there are certain people in office who have patches on their jackets. You know, that's the only way things like this happen.
That's the perfect way to explain it, the NASCAR analogy. So, I mean, where you see it's all about incentives, right? So with the EU, the party that has the most to lose is Germany. Germany is actually one of the most productive EU countries. So it's really Germany, then it's Great Britain. But Great Britain is having its own moment of nationalism, right, with Brexit. So it would be pretty hypocritical for the UK to push back hard on these types of discussions when it's kind of doing the same thing itself. And then with Germany, you know, Germany really needs the EU to sort of renegotiate some things, because if potentially the US market becomes closed or is not as open, like, they're the ones with the biggest amount to lose. And the French, who seem to be the most vocal, like, do the least amount of trade with us. Like, it's just, I mean, so I'm not saying that these things don't disrupt economic factors. They absolutely, you know, any kind of uncertainty can disrupt markets in the short run. But, I mean, this is really more of a long-run play. You can't have what's happening to a very large chunk of Americans continue to happen and it not dramatically impact the country.
Yeah. And I think it really comes down to it, you know, a lot of it being foreign manufacture, taking things like the whole concept that if you paid $5 to $10 more, your iPhone could be made here in America and instead of being made at Foxconn. Where there are just horrible things, you know, that kind of stuff. Where
it would cost that much more, because it's like, I think, and my stats might be old, but it was something like the iPhone 6 was like a 60% profit margin, and then you want to talk about who is. You know, we're constantly hearing in the news like, oh, big corporations are hoarding cash overseas. Guess who's hoarding cash overseas? It's Apple. So they're moving their production to China so the American consumer can pay less for products, but then they're actually not paying any taxes on the profit that's coming in. It's a big scam, actually.
It is. Yeah. You know, it just things like that. Like I would be concerned with anything Tesla. Like I have yet to see them be actively successful as a model or as a business, sans government funding.
Yep. Yeah. So here's a stat that I dug up. Tech companies account for 56% of the total increases of corporate cash between 2009 and 2014. So when you're talking about companies that are hoarding cash and not investing and like not growing industry, the bullseye is tech companies.
Wow. How about that? And it's because you're kind of working in an ethereal plane in a lot of ways. You're working with a lot of theoreticals. So yeah, you can shift a lot of numbers around and do all kinds of fun stuff. I mean, I remember I worked a conference, where, a person for a company much like that got up and was talking about their new technology that was going to be able to power your home. And we just went and did a huge solar study where our battery would power your home if it was attached to the electric grid. And it was, it was only a third the cost of standard power and fossil fuel. And I was like, well, wait a minute. You did a solar study near the equator. There tends to be a little bit more daylight there with a little bit more intensity. You're also on an island with an isolated power grid. And if I'm not mistaken, they don't produce any fossil fuels in Hawaii. They're all shipped in, which would probably make them 2 to 3 times the cost anyway.
Yeah,
But at the same time, here was the whole audience like, harumph, harumph. Like, yeah, good stuff. And I'm like, nobody's going to, like, raise a hand and question these numbers? That just seems like a skewed way to do it. Like, let's do it in Nebraska on the aging power grid that's here in America and see if we get the same numbers, you know? It just seemed like a loaded study.
I think one of the best ways to sort of, so there's so many numbers and studies and this and that. I mean, as I think, and even with the news, Chris, you and I were talking a little bit before this interview started, and we were talking about this Pew study where 70% of Americans are just completely exhausted by the news. Like, they're just completely, they're fed up with the news. And if you dig into partisanship, I think it's 77% of Republicans are fed up with the news. And it's this idea that they don't feel like they can trust the news. They don't feel like the fake news thing, right? There's so much information out there. And in this era of, you know, everyone having a voice, we're sort of getting to this place of, if everyone's talking, what do you have? You have white noise. You have no ability to parse out the small little things that matter. Right. And so we're getting frustrated to the point of just not even paying attention anymore. I think one statistic that can give you sort of a macro, like 10,000 foot in the air view of what's happening, like what's happening in America is GDP. Right. So sure. GDP or the historic average of GDP over the past 70 years is 3.25%. That is basically the productivity of all of our industry and how it's growing year on year. Now, we are lucky over the past 8 years to even crack 2%, right? So historic 70-year average of 3.25%, right now it's a little bit more than 2%. For every percent of GDP that is missing from the historical norm, that is $180 billion zapped from the economy every year. Over 10 years, it's $1.8 trillion. So not to get so caught up in these numbers, but the basic point I'm trying to make is you can't have the stock market be at all-time highs and house prices like nearing all-time highs and say, hey, everything is great, the economy is great, when you have GDP missing a whole percent from the 70-year norm. That 1% that's missing represents $180 billion every year that is just not in the economy anymore. And that is like the clearest place to see that something is wrong.
Yeah. And, you know, that's just it. It's been in a steady state. And it's weird because, like, our dollar isn't even based on anything anymore. They could just wake up and say, it's worth this. And it's the strangest thing in the world, the way our economy works nowadays. But the one thing, like you said, that is guaranteed is the gross domestic product. What we are outputting as a country, what we are actively getting out there, what we are producing and manufacturing. And unfortunately, that's kind of been in a steady state of decline because, we've been outsourcing most of that.
Yeah, so none of this is an endorsement of Trump. It's not an endorsement of any political party. I personally believe that you have to take a buyer beware approach with every single politician, every single party. Everyone's got their own incentives.
That's right.
But as far as trade goes, I kind of understand why we should be shaking this up. And I'm curious by everything that's happening right now because I think there's a huge disincentive to shake things up. I think anyone who is in a position of power and attacking this issue is doing it at odds with the Democratic establishment, with the Republican establishment, with the largest companies in America. So it takes some kahunas to do that. I would love to see something happen. And I think, you know, for anyone listening out there, I would not worry so much about what you're hearing in the press and do a little digging to find out for yourself why this matters.
Yeah. And, understand that that we as average Americans are not the ones that are the direct impactees of a lot of this stuff. We have to make sure that we keep our course, that we keep doing our thing, and keep our world strong. Because otherwise, it will be run by corporations, unfortunately.
You can't have a long-term, you can't have a long-term society where the majority of Americans are hemorrhaging, like where they're just, they're so economically unstable that they're hemorrhaging. That does not lead to good things. That is, it is just a recipe for disaster.
Exactly. And, you know, we hear all the time about the jobs market increasing, more jobs, more jobs, more jobs. The real question is, how many of those jobs are full-time jobs? How many of those jobs are sustainable jobs? How many of those jobs are jobs that will be there within the next 5 years? Temporary jobs are great. Part-time jobs are awesome. But the, like you were saying earlier, the fact that 30, 40 years ago, the average blue-collar worker could support a family of four. I was one of those people whose mother worked two jobs and went to college. She graduated high school, college the same year my brother graduated high school, or college, actually.
Wow.
They graduated college at the same time, is what it was.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and she finally got to go out and become a teacher and then realized the beauty of becoming a teacher and the fact that all the money that she had paid in to Social Security for years and years, having a job, went to absolutely nothing.
Right.
And that's like a whole other basket and barrel of fish, folks. But this is the situation that we have put ourselves in. This is a situation that most of us choose to just obligingly go by and kind of see happen around us without taking the time to understand its impact and understand our place in it.
Yeah, and you know, I don't see what's so offensive about this idea that our government and our leadership, our political leadership, should be laser focused on making sure that more and more Americans have the ability to earn a livelihood. I don't see what's so offensive about that. And putting your family first and putting your country first is actually what you see lots of other countries do. Like you go to India and you can't even sell into the Indian economy unless you have a 50% Indian partner. It's like that in a lot of the Middle East. And you look at China and it's the same thing. It's I remember going to a conference in Vegas for hedge funds, and I think Bush was one of the speakers. And again, not endorsing W, but he made a really interesting comment. In his time as president, he would interview different world leaders. He would ask them the same question, which was, what keeps you up at night? And for the president of China, it was making sure every Chinese person has the ability to get a job. Because the Chinese president understood that when people can't get jobs, that's when you have civil unrest.
Yeah. Yeah. And they themselves actually lifted their two-child policy because they realized that metrically they would end up with an economy that could not support itself. Eventually, they would not have a renewable workforce. There would not be enough people in the country to maintain the economy. That just happened like in the last year. Yeah. It was a major policy shift, you know, like we've heard about that in history class our whole life, you know, and yeah, they changed it. It was a pretty landmark issue when it happened.
I used to make 5 trips to China for work. This was like 10 years ago. I used to go to China very regularly in the mainland, and apparently you can buy your way out of that. So you can buy the ability to have additional children. I think it costs like $50,000 or $60,000, something like that. But this whole one-child policy was really something, again, where depending on, you know, your level of status, you're exempt from these policies.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, it was very much like that in just about any communist country. As long as you are in the upper class and you've got the money, sure. Why wouldn't you be able to do that? As long as you can pay the government, we're all good. and we've gotten to some data, like I said earlier. I love the beautiful experiment that is America, socially, the purest concept of what America is supposed to be as a social experiment. Because yes, we are different than any other country. Our beautiful piece of paper, that Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, are what make us different than any other country, and our system of economy with capitalism is what makes us different than most countries. What would you say, as we just get ready to close things out here, Monica? I know you have to go and take care of stuff. You're still on the East Coast with media runs, all that kind of good business. But what would you say are three things that the average American can do to kind of take more steps into the economy, become a little bit more involved, become a little bit more educated on what they can do and what their impact is and how they can help themselves? And what would you say are a few steps that we aren't entrepreneurs can take and do?
So I'll give you a twofer. This is for the entrepreneurs and for the average Americans. Really, okay. Get on top of your finances, because so much of your ability to withstand and take risks and kind of move towards your life goals comes from having adequate savings and being able to take those risks. And so it's really not about watching Fox Business or CNBC all day. The people that get the best returns are the ones that follow portfolio theory. It's this idea that, there's, as long as you're diversified and you have money spread across between large cap value, large cap growth, mid cap, like just very basic buckets, as long as you maintain your portfolio in these very basic buckets, you will beat most active investors. You just will. It's kind of what Warren Buffett has been advocating for a long time too. So the only way to really participate and have your money start working for you is by having a focus on savings. And savings comes down to, you know, just watching what you spend, watching what you earn, but it's a lot more about what you spend than it is about what you earn. So the biggest thing you can do for yourself in terms of your ability to take entrepreneurial risks and just be able to like course your life to the place that you want to course it to is have a laser focused on your finances and do whatever you can to increase your savings rate. I would say the second thing is mind the company you keep. And I guess this again is for the entrepreneurs and for average Americans. There's so much research that shows that the people you surround yourself with permeate all aspects of your personality. If you spend more time with accountants and lawyers who've never taken risks, the likelihood that you're going to take a risk is much, much lower. I think it's the Kauffman Foundation that had a study that shows that children of entrepreneurs are twice as likely to become entrepreneurs when they grow up. And all then right. so are people who know other entrepreneurs that have realized that success. Like, always look around you and think about, what are your goals in life? What are you trying to achieve? And for example, if your goal right now is to be an entrepreneur, then spend less time with your accountant and lawyer friends. Like, find people who do take risks and make sure that those are the people who you're asking for advice. And then I would say also at the same token, just buyer beware. Like, I don't believe in isms and ologies and philosophies. I think all of these things are great for books, but in the real world, there's friction. And so the only way for us to be good stewards of our families and our neighbors and our friends is to always think about, well, what are the incentive systems? Why is this person saying this thing to me? And think for yourself. And that's easier to do when you don't surround yourself with a lot of news. So here you have someone who's on the news a lot telling you to not be so worried about getting latest breaking information, and maybe wait a week, because then they'll get the story right when you read it.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And I've said that constantly on this show. Probably Denzel Washington said it best in this last election, when people came up and said, like, oh, you know, we heard that you flip-flopped and you're a Trump supporter. He's like, where'd you hear that? He's like, who told you that? Did I tell you that? Did you come to me and get that information? Because no. Like, you people are too busy chasing a headline instead of taking your time to get a story right.
You best not mess with Denzel.
And it was like, wow. Like, oh, man. And that's just it. And I remember being on air and hearing that, like, what's going on? What's happening? Like, we have to be on the, and, you know, I'll admit it, even as a show host, like, I had a show about electronic harassment 2 weeks ago, and all of 3 days ago, I saw an article about it, and some people at the Chinese embassy being sick, possibly from electronic harassment, and I sent the article to my guest, and I was like, look at that. We were like right on the pulse of stuff. Hot diggity.
Wow.
You know, you can't beat that kind of traction whenever it the curves match up. But and if you become a news hound, if you learn to kind of comb through and sift through all that stuff, you can see these curves. They are plain as day. The way that they chase stories, the way that they put stories out, the way that they push stories, in the media. And it is an absolute, like Monica said, let the flame cool down before you look at it, you know, let it become
like a
candle instead of a firework.
I think in the age of so much information, it's, again, it really goes back to, can you really ID what matters? Because most of this doesn't matter. And when you're drowning with all kinds of headlines and data points and shouting and screaming and outrage, it's very hard to identify the things that actually matter and take action when they do matter. And I mean, I find that it's a competitive advantage to just not participate. participate. And then when you actually need to talk about a topic, then do your own diligence. And then you seem to be able to skate past a lot of the talking points and have something interesting and different to say.
Yeah. Yeah. Beautifully said, Monica. As we close out, let everybody know where they can go to get themselves a copy of The Entrepreneurial Instinct. We'll, of course, have links to it and things like that in our episode post to make it nice and easy as well. But where can they go to find out more about your appearances? You speak regularly. You're all over the media. You're in numerous. I see you all the time with you and your beautiful daughter taking pictures in studios, getting ready to go on the air. Where can they go to find more information about Monica Mehta? And what she does.
Oh, you're so sweet. So if you're interested in The Entrepreneurial Instinct, you can find it on Amazon. I'm actually not so high on social media. Again, I find it exhausting. I find the whole thing, I don't, you won't, if you follow me, you won't really hear much from me other than, hey, I'm going to be on CNN later. That's about it. Yep. For me, I do this for me. It gives me a lot of satisfaction in life to be able to look at big picture issues. But if you want to see what I'm going to be on and hear what I have to say, you can check out my public Facebook page, and that's where I usually post stuff, and sometimes on LinkedIn as well. But all I'm trying to do is bring my background with economics and finance to a world where people seem to always just see it black and white, you know, Republican and Democrat, and I promise whatever opinions I give you will be my own and they will not be partisan. So.
Exactly. And I can't thank you enough. I've been working on getting you on the show for a while, and I'm so happy that we could finally line things up. I'd love to have you on again some point whenever more things happen in economics, especially whenever your new book comes out. Because and as that develops, especially with the conversation that's going on not only in our own country but worldwide right now, with women, women's rights. I would love to have you on more to discuss that topic as well, Monica.
Of course, it would be my pleasure.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time. Please do hold the line. While you're online checking out all the great work of Monica Mehta, please feel free to stop on by the Dudes and Beer podcast. That is where you can find all of our episodes. That's where you can find everything that is Dudes and Beer. We are a part of the HC Universal Network. Make sure to check out our other podcasts, Talking Sound podcast, Scary Dad podcast, Yes But Why, John Bound Politics, all kinds of good stuff there. That is HCUniversalNetwork.com. Until next time, if you can't be good, be good at it, folks.
We'll talk to you soon. Listen to our audio streams or chat with us live. Download the official Dudes and Beer app for Android and iDevices, available on Google Play and iTunes markets. For more episodes, content, and information, visit us online at dudesandbeer.com. You can also find our episodes on Breach.tv, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, SoundCloud, iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Dudes and Beer is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more about our sponsors and other podcasts on this network, visit HCUniversalNetwork.com. Thanks for listening, everybody. And until next time, drink responsibly.